I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Natalie. It's lovely to be here and to see so many people. It's a real privilege to be talking to Holly, who is someone I've admired for a long time. As was explained, Holly is the author of Comic Timing, which is a personal favourite of mine, and of course The Lodgers, which is the reason for us all being here today. For anyone who hasn't read it, and you'd be forgiven because it came out, like you said, just a couple of days ago.
Thursday.
The Lodgers is a novel, a story about people who are trapped in what is unfortunately an all too relatable experience for millions of people in this country at the moment of precarious, unstable, shared living arrangements. It's a novel that's very much situated in the present housing crisis. That being said, it's not really a work of social realism, necessarily. At times, very, very funny. At other times, haunting, eerie, dreamlike. It's being described by the author, Kieran Goddard, and other people that I've spoken to as a ghost story of kind. And as such, I think it captures the emotional and psychological ramifications of that experience unlike anything I've ever read. So congratulations, Holly. It was a joy to read and gratifying to read as well as somebody who has lived in those situations. I think you wanted to start by doing a reading.
I thought you've all come all this way. Oh, some of the way you've come out in the rain or the wind. So I'll read, I mean, part of the structure of the novel, I guess, which is in tune with this kind of condition of long-term, like when I say long-term, I mean deep long-term kind of housing precarity, like lifelong tenancy really, is the sort of lack of plot, lack of futurity, lack of story, and sort of thinking through a sort of static being. So this is just to say there's no need for me to tell you much of what's happened so far if I read in the middle. And the chapters alternate between a character who is lodging with a single mother and her little girl in a little house somewhere in suburbia, somewhere in the UK, Little England somewhere. And the narrator, who has a character of her own, is the other half, the alternating story. And she's moved back to her hometown and is sort of weirdly semi-obsessed with her mother, who she can't even call mother. She calls her Moffa, some sort of fucked up relationship there. You have to read the book to think more about that. Or just talk to me. Or, you know, talk to your own mother, maybe. So, yes, but she's narrating it. She has her own story. But she was the previous lodger of the house that she is now sort of narrating and the relationship she's narrating. This is all to say that Holly Pester can't write a novel without wondering who the hell is telling this story. Surely she has to have some sort of character as well. So, you know, there's no second or third person without knowing who's telling this story. So this is from one of the narrator's sections, and it's called Moffa the Leaving. The scowling small town had me by the ankles, pulling me down. I considered leaving, but that felt too familiar. A dumb accident I was doomed to repeat. Madden, this is some guy that keeps showing up and inviting her to a pub quiz. Madden had come to my flat. I don't know how he knew where I lived or how he got past the first doors, but when I came back after an hour or so of sitting on Moffa's armchair, there was a plastic box of very spicy-looking chicken curry on my doorstep. It was full of bones and grease, great lumps of potatoes and chilli. On top was a homemade leaflet for a pub quiz. Seeing it made me furious. I went inside, searching idiotically for places to go and things to do. Jobs in hospitals for women. Retreats for free in Scotland. Trains at night. I calmed down and sat on the bed where I couldn't sleep or remember what my plan was, what my fate was. Who was I? Who was I? Here's some context. I tried to leave Moffa when I was 16. I stopped being able to look at her. I started visiting the city near our small town by bus, walking into grown-up pubs and ordering things for myself at the bar. I discovered that I liked to sit and crunch through a bag of salty crisps whilst doing a puzzle. That felt like me, so I elaborated on it. Eventually, I found that I liked going into a particular pub where they let me pretend to be an adult, sitting at a table by the door, eating a bag of salt and vinegar crisps and drinking lemonade, into which I dropped a pickled onion. Sometimes two pickled onions. So I could say to myself, what I like to do is this, and eat these, and I've brought myself here just for that. Sometimes a song came on, the speakers that I enjoyed. My song, I like this. There wasn't room for these realisations in Moffa's house. Only in the city and through my desire to eat crisps and drink lemonade with pickled onions in it was I able to notice what I was allowed to want. There was a personality forming somewhere in the choice between one bag of crisps and another, and of the amount of onions I had in my lemonade, the timings, the flavour, the price. Would I rather have a bag now or later? Will it be nice? Why should I have crisps? Why shouldn't I? From these questions and observations, it was a small leap into being a person. I felt like me. But me was someone who lived mainly on the verge of actions, someone who was always going to fall in between leaving and arriving, rationing and crunching. Could I be whole? Could I become the juicy singular triangle of myself, finance, pleasure, shelter? I was someone who didn't have anywhere to put their stuff where they lived. I was a teenage girl who had a bedroom without any room for her things. My only base, the tiny room in Moffa's house, was a storage room full of cabinets and boxes from Moffa's mother's flat after she died. Moffa's mother's flat. Piles of large stale coats and dresses, desiccating books and photo albums squatted around me like mumbling ancestors. The sliding doors of the fixed wardrobe were off their rails and would fall outwards, revealing packed-in bedding and more clothes, some wigs. A younger girl would have played with it all, punched things and shoved herself into the wardrobe. But to me, all the clutter felt like being screamed at. Sometimes even that bedroom was rented out to someone, a stranger, someone who made me feel shy, someone with a booming voice, and I'd have to sleep on the fold-out bed on Moffa's floor. At 17, I moved to the city, into a bedroom at the top of Annie the Goth's house. She was a friend of someone's friend or a big sister or an aunt. Her house was cold and damp, almost too empty and rough. I came back a month later and tried to show Moffa photos of the rooms in the house and all the nice people in them, but nothing looked as interesting as they felt. Perhaps that's because nothing and nobody was. The small bedroom I returned to was still full of boxes, but had evidently been cleaned and made to look homely. Later I found out Moffa had rented the room to a man called Ali, who drove a taxi and was sad to leave when I suddenly wanted to come back. At 18, I left again for college, came back often and throughout for no reason. Every time I had less and less to tell Moffa about where I'd been and what I'd done, I'd hardly moved on. So I shushed, retreated into corners and blankets. For a year or so, I occupied Moffa's house quietly, without confidence. You need to have a character to be audible. I used to make her jump. I would suddenly be right behind her in the lounge. She would scream, look at me and sigh, then go out for the night. Moffa was weird in the way she dressed and spoke to herself, living in a world that I didn't feature in. Overall, she seemed happy existing as if I did not, bursting into opera whenever I asked a question, always only making one cup of tea. My presence was too close to a bad dream that kept coming back. As soon as my silent moods got too much of an effort, even for me, I left again, did a few things that got me more into debt, came back, left, signed up to another tenancy. I lived with a few men and a few women. Some were strangers who smelt funny in the morning. Others were what people call partners, but I don't. Someone sulky and just for a while. I trained to be a medical librarian while he trained to be a teacher. We shared a semi-fictional happiness in a greenish borough of a city. We did things like thoroughly researching and choosing some room colours for walls we were allowed to paint that we stared at like penguins and I'll never see again. I was with someone jolly but chronically ill, with someone who smoked and with someone who swam, all on and off for bits of an exorbitant bit of unfruitful decade. I've co-owned cooking utensils and DIY tools, bed linen, houseplants. I've desperately sought and subsequently desperately got rid of furniture. Who knows where it goes? I've cried over the breakages of beautiful ceramics that I wouldn't care about if they were magically returned to me whole. I've lost bikes. I've worriedly cut bushes back. I've tried to trick and tempt and triangulate work and love and their materials into an order. It never works. I was more myself living in the margin of Moffa's house. That is where I learned, like you, to lodge. I mean, adapt and hide my needs rather than dig down. Simply hover without much substance, meekly occupy as the tenant of the tenant. It's how I was born.
That was wonderful.
Sorry, I couldn't help but laugh because as you were listing off the list of different people you lived with, naturally one starts to think of all the strange people one has lived with over the years under duress. So what strikes me about this novel is the fact that the novel as a form, kind of depends on this, you know, a central character that's kind of coherent in some way. And what's interesting is that this book kind of deals, the subject of this book is the fact that through kind of material hardship, it's really difficult for anyone to forge a kind of solid or coherent sense of self, which seems like an impossible challenge to a writer. Mm-hmm. And I want to know why you set yourself that challenge, because it seems really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy terming it an experimental novel because, mm-hmm. because there are limitations and you have to be kind of resourceful when it's like, well, this is a character who doesn't really have much of a subjectivity or life. And therefore, you know, navigating how to tell her story will just come down to sort of strange kind of loops of mania, I guess, and dreamlike kind of memory. But there's something so, I mean, the other side of the story, which is a young woman lodging with her mother and her child, as something I picked up in your book as well, is like inherently novel-y. Like it's the most novel-y. I don't know if anyone's ever lodged with a family before, but you feel like you're in a novel. It's the most, so it was almost impossible not to be a novel. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think it's because you're kind of narrating, because you're sort of not the direct participant, you're an observer to another person, another set of people's dynamics. You essentially narrate what's happening around you. It's like you say, it lends itself to storytelling.
Yeah, that's it. That kind of you are narrating, like, I am allowed in the kitchen now.
Yeah. This is when they go and do this.
Yeah,
this
I should probably leave the kitchen now. I will return to the small room.
It's interesting you talked about sort of social realism and wanting to approach this from a more experimental tradition because obviously, I think it's something that we have in common is frustration with the fact that these stories are rarely given airtime in mainstream and literary culture. It's getting better, and this novel is testament to that. But where we are kind of permitted to talk about class and financial hardship is normally in a kind of social realist tradition.
Right.
You know, we're allowed to have gritty tales of struggle and overcoming difficulty, but rarely are we allowed to kind of be creative, poetic, interpretive of that experience. And so I also wanted to know what some of the challenges are in approaching what is essentially like material conditions, but from a more poetic or experimental perspective.
It's really nice. Yeah, and I think in terms of the history of the avant-garde and the history of experimental literature, I'm more excited when it's written by someone who is matching kind of limited or innovative methods with a kind of limited, innovative way to live, and I think, yeah, you know, which often comes from hardship or a need to be resourceful with your materials and find a way. And for me, that those two things go together. It's also an expression of something that suddenly feels quite comic as well. Like it's like condition of the comic is that you are kind of rubbing against the norm,
yeah,
you know, or whether you meant to or not, whether you had a choice to or not, you know, where,
yeah,
you become ridiculous, and this is kind of, yeah, or you feel ridiculous and sort of wanted to kind of write in that mode, I guess.
Yeah, so. And how you kind of bounce back from various forms of resistance that you're encountering continuously, like that becomes quite a comic performance.
Yeah, yeah, and I think in terms of the influences, you know, my favourite writers are Anne Quinn, and who I've talked a lot about with Rachel, who is, you know, the experimenter who has the sort of the more kind of, yeah, she's coming from a more working class voice and situation, but also those kind of, she seems to share a kind of ambience for me with vaudeville comedy and music hall comedy and that kind of, which is also where I sort of mine a lot of attitude from, I guess. Well.
Interesting. I was going to mention Anne Quinn, because that's the writer that I immediately thought of when I was reading this book.
That's nice.
The others that came to
for me.
And I'm not just saying that. It was genuinely an authentic thought that I had. The others that sprung to mind were, and I never know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Barbara Comins. I don't know if you've ever read her work, because that can also be very funny. And strangely, with this book, not so much the poetry, but I was thinking of a couple of Doris Lessing novels as well.
Yeah. The Good Terrorist is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A very long chapter about how to unblock a toilet.
Yes.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, she's good at kind of engaging with the material world and bringing out its kind of latent absurdities in a way that I think...
I've just been reading Doris Lessing, actually, the what novel she wrote under a pen name that were these kind of like the Jenny Summers, these novels, they're just so good, but she wrote them under a pen name because they're kind of just this kind of woman's world kind of novels, but they're amazing.
Okay. Yeah. Never actually read them.
Yeah, very good. It's something Summers. Jane Summers, thank you.
Who else are you influenced by? Who do you read?
There are really key influences on this that I want to mention the names, and I also want to say who put the books in front of me, because I think that's a really important part of this. Is, you know, writing is this kind of collective endeavour. So for me, it's always worth remembering who gave you this reference point. So there's a novelist called and a writer called Hilda Hilst. I don't know if many people know her, but Latin American writer, very kind of consciously working in the tradition of Beckett and Joyce, but doing it with this way that they have in sort of South American writing, which is just amazing. So Hilda Hilst and sort of Clarice Lispector and Leonore Carrington, kind of maybe I kind of see them in a kind of... But Hilda Hilst's novel, a very particular novel that was recommended to me by Christine Krieder, called The Obscene Madam D, which is a tiny novella about a woman who... a woman who's kind of grieving her recently deceased husband, and so And so she just moves in under the stairs, and she just lives under the stairs. But and the novel is her talking to him as a ghost, and he's kind of saying, maybe you shouldn't live under the stairs anymore. And she's like, no, shut up. And then she just, the only way she leaves under the stairs is to go and pull faces at children passing her house, and then she gets back under the stairs. And there's a very long, one of my favourite ever sections about an asshole. You know, she describes an ass. If I was ever invited by The Guardian to do a top 10 novels about assholes, that would be right up there. That was just, there's an opening for that. But, it's a beautiful section. But I think that was extremely influential on me because it's so bonkers. Like, it's just beautiful. And the writing is just with all that kind of modernist, but with this feminist inflection that, you know, there's something about the kind of the older body of the woman as well that sort of feels very kind of fleshed out in the prose. And there's something about, I'm just going, the uncanniness of what you've done to the home or the space of a home, and through both the construction of the prose, but also just like she's made herself like weird, and how the prose kind of mirrors that is just wonderful. Muriel Spark's Girls of Slender Means, which is just fantastic. It's my favourite novels of all time, which is just all these kind of prototypical women, should we say, young women, kind of post-war boarding house for young women who are just on the cusp of becoming citizens. And and there's this tiny window that if you can fit through it, you get to have sex with the guy who comes onto the roof. But if you can't fit through it, you don't get to have sex. So they all go on a diet to get through the window. And then there's a bomb. Muriel Spark is just one of my absolute legends, and the way she kind of her prose is just intoxicated with the exhaustion of post-war Britain. Everyone's tired. Mm-hmm. Everyone is so tired and delirious in her novels. I find it's, and that one particularly, because I feel like the plot is just the girl circulating this space. It's kind of like this house, this boarding house. And then there was a fantastic novel, Beryl Bainbridge, is that right? Beryl Bainbridge's the Bottle Factory Outing that Luke Kennard recommended to me. And it's these two women that share a house, and they share a bed even, but they have a wall of books between them. And they go to bed and have to rebuild the wall, and then they wake up and the wall of books has collapsed, and oh, for God's sake! And that's the entire book.
Rebuild.
And that's one of those moments, I wish I'd thought of that. So good.
It's just a few. I was also thinking as well about this. I mean, it kind of just came out in pretty much all of those stories that you just described. This idea of eccentricity, of personalities that aren't sort of given the scope to kind of evolve naturally, and either are kind of entirely repressed, or if they are repressed, they might then have strange sort of like quirks that kind of creep out of the sides, and as such kind of take even odder forms, which I think is something that this book touches on. And also the figure of Moffa, the mother figure, she's kind of permitted to be eccentric in a way that perhaps an older generation was able to, because they were able to fully kind of cultivate their sense of personality and their interest and who they are. Whereas we've got that kind of in relief with this narrator.
Yeah, I find that it, I mean, it makes me think about my mum as well, but Moffa is the character Moffa, she's like the bohemian, she's an actress, she's like this kind of slightly neglectful mother who's an actress, but she is the eccentric. But I'm also interested in the way kind of society, people are forced to be eccentric against their will almost. It's just like, yeah, I have no choice but to be eccentric because I can't afford the means to be sort of like easy around people, and I think Moffa, yeah, exactly as you say, is that generation where it's like, okay, I'll be bohemian then, and I'll just have this kind of, I'll have this space that's kind of raggedy in a bohemian way. And it's and Moffa's a tenant as well. Moffa's kind of long-term renting. I see Moffa as sort of, because she's an actor, she didn't make that leap into the right to buy. That's how I see Moffa.
But, I see.
But then the daughter, who's, you know, sort of mid-30s, I guess, is kind of the eccentricity is her is discomfort. Yeah, she's that it's outside ease. It's not outside in a radical way. It's outside in a kind of cold kind of way. It's like I can't feel myself. But yeah, and I'm really interested in terms of the wider question of the housing crisis and real estate and just places like London. That what space is there to try out personality anymore? What kind of shelter is there to be an artist or to kind of just take a year off? Like, you cannot stop thinking for a second about bills, rent, you know, it's so timed. And just having a moment to be like, maybe I will be like this year. And it's this, yeah, it's, yeah. So I think this, the concept of eccentricity, I think is really interesting, where it intersects with material conditions and what if those are deliberate. And, you know, and I quite like to be a bohemian. I don't think women like that. I wanted to be one of them. Yeah. I thought that was my destiny. I was just going to have a little house or a little flat, and I was just going to, like, what don't I have, like a cigarette on a holder, and I was just, like, never dressed properly, and people were just like, ah, you. It's not how it's allowed. You can't even know you have to live in these horrible buy-to-let places with, like, plasticky floors and all clean all the time.
Yes, they do always have to be clean and white, so that they can just have this, like, constant churn of people. And their stuff, I can just kind of play backdrop to their stuff.
You're not spread out in that way. You know, you can't mushroom into yourself. You have to be very, very kind of contained.
There was one section actually that, and as we're talking about it, came to mind where it's as though the energy that one would hope to put into kind of cultivating their interests, their personality, who they are, their relationships, all that stuff, gets directed actually kind of into the household dynamics, gets consumed by the household dynamics, and almost this kind of warping effect that the material restrictions have on a person's personality and life trajectory. I actually was going to just read a little section of it because I just loved it so much. But it was like, I stayed there for some time, half a year, and then left. The situation was odd, or maybe so normal I couldn't help making it complicated. I think that's what most living setups are. You take a very banal arrangement involving someone paying to live somewhere where other people also live, or at least one other person, and without anything much happening, the whole thing becomes furiously operatic. I'd say it takes a couple of weeks for things to unravel and then reconnect hyperactively. Bodies do what they do, and the rent can only make it so rational. I stayed in that town near to the coast for the agreed 6 months and then left, and this is the place that the new tenant has now moved into to occupy. No goodbyes. A new woman is arriving there now. That's probably true. Today is just the sort of day people arrive at new and knotty tenancies. Her suitcase is trundling along the pavement. And it's just this sense of anticipation of, like, you're about to enter something that's inevitably going to become chaotic or stressful or burdensome to you in some way. You just don't know quite what flavour this one will take.
And you turn up like, hi. Yeah.
And I also wanted to talk about, so obviously there's the lived experience, which you capture really beautifully, but then there's also, and I think this also plays into this kind of fractured narrative, because there's also the comparison with other people and where they're at in their lives and the conversations that are had around, there's a conversation at the end of the book where you overhear the Moffat figure, the character that overhears the Moffat figure, talking about someone who lives nearby in a gorgeous flat, some young man who's living in a beautiful flat. And there's this sense of, there's a lived experience, but also constantly seeing your life in comparison to other people and this expectation of where you ought to be at life and why you're not quite there. There's also a passage where you talk about my circumstances have changed. That refrain just repeats itself over and over and over again. This sense that you have to justify why you're living in that situation, which I just also thought was beautiful and wanted to mention.
Yeah, and at one point in the kind of lodgings where the single mother and the daughter are and the new lodger are living, at one point the single mother just decides to rent another room out and she just sleeps on the floor in her daughter's bedroom and loads of other kind of people pass through. And I've been that lodger with a single mum, but I've also been the daughter of a single mum who was fudging together the rent with lodgers, and so I kind of know that feeling of like whoever's kind of around, as from a child's point of view, is kind of like a kind of like proxy parent. Like, hi, adult, here's my homework or empty bowl. Come on, and then yeah, and being the sort of being the adult, and there's a child. It's like, oh, I guess this is my problem that you've spilt that, and these kind of wonderful messy relations that people have who aren't a family, but by this arrangement with kind of a sort of contract and some money, that yeah, you're going to have this most intimate kind of experience of over a duration of time.
Yeah, I mean, the housing crisis is always sort of, you know, reported to us in a, as it ought to be and needs to be, you know, in terms of kind of wholesale economic reality, the cold hard facts of the matter, you know, the rise of kind of corporate landlords, etc. But what's rarely spoken about is how it creates these new relationships that for which there's no precedent. There's no sort of guidebook to navigating them or knowing, you know.
Isn't Dickens.
That's
about where it is.
That's a bit worrying, isn't it? That the only precedent is back in like Dickensian times. That's great. That's good news for all of us.
Yeah, the landlady with her like, you know, hoarded tenants and they're all sharing the hot water. But yeah.
Yeah. And can we just go back to talking about this you character? Because we mentioned it previously, but
yeah.
Because I think it's one of the, I think it's a really distinctive aspect of this book, and it's probably the one that most people will start. It was certainly the first thing I wanted to talk about when I encountered other readers. Where did the idea come from to have this you character?
Yeah, I mean, and first of all, I want to apologise for writing in second person. Like, as I was writing, like, you can't be doing this. You can't write. I hate novels in second person. And I was always meant to go back and change it, but then it was like, it's just happening now, isn't it? This is what it is now.
Just to be very clear, so half of the book, like, as it alternates, it's a first-person narrative and then a second-person narrative that's directed to this character, you.
Yes,
yeah, so
you is the new lodger who is lodging with the mum and the girl. And I think that was how I started. I wanted to write about the lodger lodging with, because the class lines don't, we haven't kind of talked about this, we talked vaguely about class, but the class lines don't fall where you think that the single mother is working class and she has lots of side hustles. She also rents the bedroom out while the lodger is doing her course to kind of do beauty treatments, and she has lots of kind of other side hustles, and she's just making it work that way. And yeah, the lodger is probably more, has access to more debt in that way, and is kind of taking on more debt and living that kind of more younger millennial kind of circulation of tenancies and tasks and stuff. But so I wanted to tell her story, and I was writing in second person. I was like, oh, this is Grace, why are you doing that? And I was like, well, somebody must be talking about her. Somebody must be seeing her. Who could possibly be seeing this situation? I was like, well, it must be the previous lodger. And it must be the person that knows exactly what she's feeling and how she's feeling and has lain in that bed and kind of knows the rhythms of that house, but has a slightly kind of diverging narrative at certain points. But because of the coincidence of material conditions, it's almost like their lives are identical.
Yeah.
So I wanted that kind of something as banal as a lodging contract to kind of almost replicate people, because this is, I think this goes back to our kind of conversation about eccentricity, because it's like, well, we are kind of categorized and we are kind of genres of our tenancy in that kind of way.
Yeah. There's a script almost.
Right.
That has to be followed by everybody.
So who is saying this? And then it must be the previous lodger. And I guess that's that kind of telepathy of the novel is also something, as a poet, I can't quite get over. Like, I'm not a natural novelist. I can't quite just accept that someone is seeing something happening. I was like, who's seeing this and why? and is it her hallucination? But it's like you are invited to kind of believe that it is both her speculative project and just so happens to also be exactly what is
reality,
and as reality in a novel ever is, right?
Yeah.
So it's that kind of aperture of the novel is just happens to be the coincidence of how two people have lived.
Yep.
But they both have their own situations.
So what was the experience like of writing this, having been a poet? And I came to your work through poetry, and I think you're a wonderful poet. How did this process differ? I mean, apart from what might be quite obvious.
I think it's just because I don't know if I would write another novel. I'd like to. I've got some ideas. But I think it's just this is, it's kind of almost gothic. It's like, again, it's Dickensian. It feels like, yeah, it felt like kind of stepping into Miller's bracket. It's a novelistic kind of condition to lodge, to rent. Yeah. But yeah, so it felt like the sort of necessary like demand of the idea to kind of write in prose.
I see.
Yeah. And
I was going to ask as well, this idea of, you touched on it very briefly, of this idea of therapy, because there's a line in there about kind of learning these alternative therapies and to like, as a kind of curative for people, for other people in similar situations who are going through these horrible kind of ordeals.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's weird, isn't it? That's weird.
So studying forms of therapy that are then used and sold to people who are kind of underpaid but kind of forced to go and try and resolve their depression, their resulting depression or anxiety, whatever it is, through seeking therapy. I also quite liked that strange kind of symbiosis.
Forgot that not only did they also, they both lodged in this bedroom, they also did the same course at the nearby, which is to kind of train in this completely made up kind of therapy. Actually, not entirely made up, because it's weird what came up on my phone after I started writing it. It was like, turn your trauma into a way to earn money. And it was like, what's this? And then there was this advert for this woman whose husband had died in a scuba diving accident, and she'd worked out a way to use that narrative as a way to sort of heal other people. Right. I was like, okay, this is... So I've invented a kind of therapeutic method out of something like that, that they're both studying, they're both doing, they've done the course. Like the narrators did that course and lodged and left, and the current lodger is doing that course. But yeah, it's about kind of turning your trauma into special massage techniques.
Yeah, it conjured just a beautiful image in my mind of this strange, circuitous thing. These people are struggling and they're learning this therapy that's meant to like help other people who are struggling in the same thing. And just this seems like this Ouroboros, quite hellish scenario. Was that our indication? Oh, sorry. it just seemed like this kind of horrific a trap that everyone was stuck in, unable to leave. And I wanted as well, because I didn't get to elaborate on that, but you cited a couple of sort of magic realist writers. And I wanted to actually describe the novel in that way and then pulled back from doing so because I didn't know if you were comfortable with that categorisation, but it felt as though it was inspired by magic realism.
Yeah, I think more surrealism, I guess.
Surrealism.
Is my kind of artistic home.
Okay.
Ultimately. Yeah. It's also got the laziest lipogram in it of all time. nobody would ever notice, but it's not got the word home in it at all until the very last line. Mm. I know, George Perec, eat your heart out. I really broke a sweat sometimes. And then she got back. But I was like, I do think at some level it's kind of embedded some sort of like discomfort into the fabric of the prose, which is this kind of discomfort of being, right? Because home is used as an adjective. It's things are homely or unhomely all the time. Like it's a measure in kind of an ideal state of being, but it's not a place or thing anyone can have or talk about.
Mm. That's just very interesting because I feel as though there's a generation of people who have a very strange relationship with that word.
Yeah.
I've spoken to friends who feel like they've really kind of like crossed a threshold when they refer to the place that isn't their parents' place as their home for the first time. And that's happening at middle age. They go home for, people are going home for Christmas,
Is it the kind of the stress that we put on it? I'm going home.
Home. Yes, but like you say, is that sense? And I think towards the end of the novel, there's something about it being like a home is a place where like there's just noise happening. The kettle's on. There's ambient noise from just activity and life, which is always missing from these very kind of hollow, faceless places that we essentially we occupy rather than sort of living in.
Yeah.
Is a fair way to characterise it, maybe.
And that's, like, the way they're designed. I mean, we kind of... I wanted... Having read your book... it's magnificent. But and I'm thinking about the aesthetics of buy-to-let, and this is where many of us are kind of living in. That's our kind of milieu, isn't it? The kind of buy-to-let. And I can see Sam Shee Johnson in my eye line, who's written so wonderfully about this as well in Living Rooms. But... And I was reading, with your book, I was reading it alongside Hal Foster's Design and Crime.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And there's this amazing phrase that he steals from a design critic who was talking about Art Nouveau. And he said Art Nouveau is like living with your own corpse. Because, like, even an ashtray is like fucking flowers, there's nowhere left for your subjectivity to run. But the buy-to-let kind of aesthetic, the kind of plasticky kind of live, laugh, love kind of stuff everywhere, and the sort of laminated floorboards, that's like living with your own corpse. Like that, like calling that home, like I'm not surprised that people kind of like trip over themselves saying it, because it's like, it's every kind of design decision, and you've written so beautifully about this, is for someone else's profit. It's not for your own comfort. The last time it was like the worst kind of landlords are the ones that are kind of just have just got enough to just buy one place that they want to rent out. So they want to eke out as much money from it as possible. They're kind of amateur landlords are the worst. And they've done everything as cheaply as possible. They've bought the nastiest kind of cat, but they've bought too much as well. It's
like there is always too much stuff.
Like an Airbnb. And it's like, no, you don't even understand how to be a landlord. And it's like, they just fill it with like decorative things. Like they had this like one that had a sort of place for me to hang my keys that said home and with like little chickens on it, and obviously it broke, and then it's like, okay, well that's coming out of my deposit, isn't it? So I didn't want that. This kind of distressed look object. And like, yeah, and when I went to see it, I had this lovely comfy sofa, and I was like, oh, that's going to be great. He's like, oh, it's going, takes up too much room. It's like, whose room exactly is it taking up? Because I quite like it. And then he replaced it with these... They were the kind of Asda versions of those maid sofas that were kind of sitting up. Mm-hmm. There was one downstairs. It's like very good for a bookshop, but you can't...
Oh, I always... I'm day at work, by those.
You can't kind of come home and relax on this. This isn't for my life. This is for your... And that's what many of us are living in, that kind of discomfort, which is like... My subjectivity has nowhere to run in this place. Like,
they should let you have a go at it, landlording. It sounds like you do a much better job than most people.
I'm going to make it so weird.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm quite interested in how that, like, that idea of homeliness has essentially been, like, aestheticised and, like, sold back to us as a kind of, like, it's now, like, the aesthetic of ownership, but it's almost like a kind of cliche or exaggeration of, like, homeliness, and that it's this kind of like Dickensian, just Dickensian probably isn't the right word given the connotations it's had in this conversation, but this sort of like excessively kind of like oldie worldy comfort, cozy, dark colours, lots of foliage and brass objects and soft furnishings, very dark
painting
and kind of closeting. Yes, it was interesting actually that you mentioned that, because I hadn't thought about it in the context of your book, but it's true. And I just wanted to also talk about the kind of the subjectivity of, we've just quickly got time, the subjectivity of that, and I'm sorry, I keep coming back to the you character because it's just so, it's just so interesting to me, and how you then kind of resolve that into the kind of like overarching narrative of the book.
Say that again.
So how you kind of, because the two stories at first, they seem to like run kind of concurrently.
Oh, yeah.
And then they seem to kind of like diverge. And I just sort of wanted to just know about how you approach the form and the structure of the novel, basically.
I, I think the idea was, and I'm not sure if this kind of stayed with it, but the sort of the closer that they were, the closer that the you character was to the narrator in some sort of acting predictably, the sort of the more detailed and kind of bodied out the narration was. But there's a moment towards the end where the you character kind of turns into something maybe more literary and makes decisions that the narrator wouldn't. Should not give it. But yes, it diverges further from the sort of like how I, the narrator, would have behaved. And
yeah,
so there is this, I wanted to kind of like have a proximity, a psychological proximity between them, a psychic kind of connection that is lost at some point.
Yes, I see.
And that, yeah, I guess that's kind of is that the approach that you...
Yes, the reason why I stopped myself, and I didn't want to give away any spoilers, which seems ridiculous when you say, you know, it's not necessarily it's not a very like plotty novel where there's going to be some big revelation on the final page. But I do feel as though it is there's a hopeful ending. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. For okay. one of them, not the other.
Yes. I mean, we're talking here about this. because we've been talking about the kind of like the formation of identity and how these material conditions kind of limit it and prevent it and it leads to all these various forms of repression that then find weird ways of mm-hmm. contorting who we are. There's almost like a kind of an attempt of a kind to kind of at least break the cycle psychologically, if not actually and physically in terms of...
I think that's it. And I think that kind of... sort of throughout, there are like alternatives presented, but not necessarily noticed, and they're kind of flickering in the kind of margins. That's like you could have actually happiness this way is happiness, but and this way could be happiness, and neither characters notice it. They're radically uncurious of the world around them, which I find this is like kind of I was interested in kind of maintaining. They're not generous characters, and I think this is kind of like a symptom of like I don't know, but it's also just the fact that I don't find these characters very sympathetic to the people around them. And they're, yeah, so... There is a moment where it's like one of them notices that actually the sort of... the means are, you know, the means are there for something more radical, and then the other one doesn't, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, without giving too much away. I'm not very good at doing this. I'm not very good at talking about it, kind of talking around it without divulging too much. But, I took away from it that there are sort of ways out in terms of reframing the circumstances and the conditions and thinking about them differently.
Right. Which, I mean, I believe. Like, I do believe that. I do believe that, like, you know, we have kind of power to sort of... I don't know, the sort of the deviations that we have, we can make on...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think as well, I mean, and also what I took from it, I mean, is that this sense of normalcy has been lost for almost a generation of people. So this burden that we carry personally of thinking that... We're getting quite broad strokes and philosophical here, but this kind of burden of failure that a lot of people carry for, like, not having fulfilled these certain things is actually a generation-wide thing.
Yeah.
And realising that, and that's, I think, having these two characters who are living very similar circumstances really drives home, which also in itself is a form of, if not hope, then a kind of consolation or comfort, which is another beautiful thing about the novel that I took away from it. So there was an article that was written this week about the housing crisis in fiction. I don't know whether many of you got to read it. It was written by this novelist, Kieran Goddard. And it seems that for that reason, your novel is very well timed, which is funny because that's the title of your other book.
All about timing.
All about timing. were you aware of these other books? And have you been were you thinking about writing a kind of like novel of its time? Or was that just a kind of byproduct
As I said, my reference points are these like kind of like modernist, like, like in the 50s and 60s and 80s. But I'm definitely, I love that article, but I couldn't have written it because I haven't got I love just experimental mad stuff. And yeah. And I think that kind of, I was so lucky with my editor, Rachel Allen, the magnificent Rachel Allen, who not for one second steered me towards more kind of conventional commercial expression at any point.
Yeah.
Like it was just never. It was just like you go into your weird corner and you stay there and scream and we'll publish it. Yeah, it's just incredible. And I think, but I mean, of course, we are all, this is not, it's not a trend. It's not a thematic trend. It's an expression of a condition, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's been critiqued, like all these kind of like numb voices, all these kind of like, sort of almost ghost-like female voices in contemporary literature. And it's like, I think what you'll find is that is a kind of an expression of a condition that's spoken by. I mean, this generation are younger than all those novels. It was very nice of Kieran to make me sound like I was under 40. And I was like, you've really made me sound like a young novelist. This is lovely.
I think you are. novelist
fans. But it was well. Like, yeah, I think I feel kind of, yes, this wanting to be working in a kind of avant-garde condition and working in experimental writing is like, yeah, the experimental beingness of Tenancy is kind of where it is.
As you were saying that, it was reminding me of something I'd read recently, and I realised it was something that Rachel, your editor, had written about class and publishing. And
of course, yeah, it's amazing.
It was for a journal called Too Little Too Hard, which is a project run by two poets. And this essay is about the kind of the conditions that working people are kind of subject to in the publishing industry. And like you say, it's kind of, if working class people are kind of permitted to enter that space, it is normally under the duress of having to be like commercially viable, probably more so than someone who is able to be kind of self-funded and support themselves while they experiment. So that is also a wonderful thing to see.
It is, isn't it?
It's remarkable. It's rare and it's unusual and it's kind of quite a big thing to get your head around.
No, and I think, you know, it's down to Rachel with time. Mm. Yeah, very grateful.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Time for questions. Yes. Oh, and the mic's over there, so if anyone has any questions.
Put up your hands if you've got questions.
Hi. Thank you so much, Holly. That was amazing. I suppose hearing you talk about the word home and thinking about home as kind of like not a place as much as like an affect or, an aspiration, I was interested if your experience of COVID and the language around homing and being at home came into your thinking around the novel and like stay at home. It's this weird thing where we like, as if we all have a home.
Of course. Yeah. No, you're so right. It was all around the same time. When I was writing this, it was around then, just after. Yeah. And it wasn't home wasn't necessarily the word. It was a household. It was like your unit, your household was like was where you had to stay. But which, of course, was for so many people. It's like, well, I didn't live with this person. I don't even know. It was like, I have to stay with this guy that sort of makes a weird noise when he eats. No, thank you. Forever, constant, nobody else. Yeah, so, yeah, I was absolutely, I must have been driven by that kind of this. I was angry about that as well, and I'm sure many other people were. I mean, it was so Tory, wasn't it? It was their rhetoric to a T, wasn't it, of kind of family and home being this stable kind of unit that by which society is kind of measured by, you know, household data. That, like, I was doing a lot of research at the time about the census and the history of the census and the sort of history of measuring people via households, and it was really interesting. Absolutely.
Yeah, the term household, actually, it's strange. I hadn't thought about that, but that is how it was characterised. And the assumption always was that everyone's living 2.4 children, heterosexual relationship.
And there is a head of the household.
Still. Head of the household.
And how everybody relates to each other by the household is on the census is all through familial categories.
Yeah.
You can't say, well, we met in a room, I think, at Jenny's house. Once. Yeah. There's not a tick box on that to the census.
No, what were your living situations?
Well, I was in a shared flat in Dalston, which was tiny, and I could feel that it was about to just be a nightmare. So I moved back to my hometown and I rented a flat near my mother.
There you go. I see. It's all coming together.
And then this story came to me.
Was it much solace moving back to the hometown?
Nowhere was anywhere. Nowhere. So it was. There was a lot of writing, and it was. Yeah, there was a lot of online teaching as well, which was like a sort of deranged hallucination for 2 years. Yeah.
Were there any others? Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Hi. I really liked your description of living with others as like a sort of operatic drama. And like any good drama, there's normally lots of villains, like either the housemate that you build up resentment over, or your dreadful landlord, or like people that are even more powerful and systematic. So I was wondering, are there any villains in your book?
Yeah. Yeah, there is, and I think you're so right that the operatic nature and households, house shares are beautiful things. They can be so messy and so painful, but just so gorgeous. I mean, like any like a family, like a kind of relation, like a marriage, I imagine that can be. But yes, no, there is a villain. I think this is why it gets kind of sometimes described as gothic, which I love. I'm like, ooh. And it probably won't surprise you to know that he is landlord-ish and also kind of father-ish as well in his being. But yeah, and I think of him, if you read the novel, this might make more sense, but I think of him as a kind of Dracula. Like, at one point, he even occupies two times at the same time, like Dracula. And I also like to remember, I'm pretty sure Dracula was a landlord, right? That was Count Dracula. Wasn't that why he was in the UK? He wanted to
work on
his property portfolio.
Yes, I think you're right. Yeah,
he needed an accountant, right? Because he was working on his portfolio.
Yeah.
So it's all.
Have you ever read Salem's Lot, which kind of evolves that story?
Yes,
and he's a landlord there as well. He's the vampire's a landlord there as well.
Yeah. So there was a vampiric landlord, father-like figure. And if that's not a villain, I don't know.
Yeah, we didn't dwell on him or talk about him very much, but the encounters with men are very fascinating, I have to say, because it's two female central characters.
Right.
And their interactions with men are always very funny, and also kind of like stolen moments. Nothing ever feels that orchestrated. Or, sorry, conversely, too orchestrated in these kind of like horrible date scenarios that are all like very generic as well. The kind of the limitations that are imposed on even like romance or like sexuality and attraction flourishing.
Right.
Quite fascinating as well. Any others? Any more questions?
Thank you. I guess I'm quite interested in the role of like improvisation in the book, because I think you kind of touch on that and how you have to improvise your means, and that is a creative, often situated as a creative practice, but it's also a class practice. I just, yeah.
Yeah, improvising. Yeah, I think, and just making it work. Yeah. That's a really, and that's also a kind of comedic strategy as well, like, that I'm really interested in. This isn't related, and I think your point is more interesting in a way, that improvising and class relations are more interesting. But the word moffa came out of an improv piece that I made with my friend and performance art collaborator Emma Bennett. We devised moffa was just like we thought we'd have we on stage we thought we'd have an argument as if we were each other's mother. But thought it would be funnier to sort of like slightly kind of weird the word mother, and so called it like shouting at each other, saying "Moffa, stop touching me." This kind of and just, but didn't. Yeah, there was nothing scripted. It was all improvised, and so it was nice to sort of bring Moffa back in. I think a lot about the kind of radical potential of resourcefulness and reanimating kind of your material in various ways. Yeah. As a methodology, but in a life strategy as well.
You've mentioned comedy a few times and vaudeville, and who are some of the like comedic influences?
I really love Victoria Wood.
Yeah. She's quite surreal.
She's very surreal. Yeah. This is very funny. I also love Bob Mortimer very much, and he's very in here. I mean, I love female comedians, like kind of Marilyn Monroe, I would put in that category very much. And yeah, I don't know if anyone saw the Carolina Hearn documentary recently, but I found that very, very moving. And I think there was a Victoria Wood kind of sketch that I wanted to have as my epigraph, but it was too expensive or whatever. But, but it was just this hilarious sketch, where it was just an old lady character going, "Don't like legs. Get enough legs at home. Don't want to go out and see legs." And I don't even know what the hell she's talking about. This is so funny. I just thought that'd be the most amazing epigraph. And people would be like, "What?" I don't know.
That would have been amazing, can't
I? I know. But no, it was fair enough. But that kind of British kind of surreal comedy definitely. Is linked to sort of vaudeville and burlesque as well, which is,
Kind of
making, I think, because it's not a humorous novel, there's not good jokes, but I think, like, and this is something I was working with in Comic Timing as well, like a kind of the comic condition, maybe even in terms of kind of classic Greek theatre, like kind of the comic as a kind of condition of time and a condition of being, which is slightly opposed to mainstream sort of narrative.
It's definitely funny. I will say it's definitely a funny book. I laughed it many times. I also just wanted to quickly just point out there was that mention of Marilyn Monroe in one of your poems that I always think about how our grandmas have...
She had grandma's hair.
She had grandma's hair. When you think about your grandma's hair, she's been going to the hairdressers for however many years, 50 years, and asking for a Marilyn Monroe. That's always stuck with me.
Thank you, Ollie.
Okay, this is
the... I'll keep it quick. Thank you so much. It's been super fascinating, and I'm so excited to read the book. I just have a question about the title, and I was wondering why you decided to use the word lodger, and I've been interested in the, you know, of course, it's been coming up again and again during your conversation, because to me, and maybe it's just me, but I feel like it's a slightly sort of almost outdated term.
Yeah.
And if you're actually looking for, you know, a room to rent in London, then you'll go to spare room, or you're talking about housemates and flat shares. And it's a slightly different vocabulary. And I was wondering what that is meant, if it's meant to kind of indicate anything.
It's absolutely to deliberately hark back to that kind of old-fashioned means of like being a lodger. It is old-fashioned, isn't it? It's in Dickens and it's in Muirspark and it's in that kind of, like, yeah. And it's also a tradition. Single mothers do it. Single mothers turn to letting out rooms. It's a, you know, throughout history, and it's a kind of that is a kind of category. A kind of the woman that gets that becomes alone and has to sort of keep it going and becomes a landlady, and that was the sort of the history of that, the kind of historical present of that woman as well. I kind of wanted to kind of bring back in because she's. I mean. That it's a kind of like she doesn't, the landlady who is renting out these rooms doesn't get much of a, you know, like she doesn't get to take place much. Her story isn't told, but she's the person I'm really more interested in. And I, but you know, that's not her. Yeah. I have a lot of tenderness for her, but she's, which comes through, but she, yeah, she's radically outside.
Yeah.
Story.
It's interesting as well because it does, it complicates what it can sometimes be reduced to quite a black and white thing of like landlords and tenants.
Right.
And actually there are people who, you know, are put into a situation, I'm not here to apologize for landlords necessarily, but in this, what I liked about it was having that working class mother figure who, because of circumstances, was forced to then, she didn't want to, but, you know, have to then rent her room. And it just complicated it and sort of showed a kind of like different perspective on that phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I was just going to quickly say about, for me, when I thought about the term lodgers, because one of them is lodging, the other is a sort of tenant.
Yeah.
But I think that in kind of characterising them both as lodgers, it sort of repoliticizes the act of renting. Because when you talk about being a tenant or renting, it kind of gives it a sense of like legitimacy. And actually, if you just actually described it in the same terms as lodging, as being a lodger, essentially, of having no more rights than a lodger.
Right.
Really.
Right.
It sort of, it recontextualises, it makes you see it in a different way, and probably makes you a bit angrier about it, potentially.
It's also quite a comedy word. it's a more comedy word than renting.
Yeah, me trying to turn you into, like, a polemicist, and you're like, no, it's still
my friend Jacob said he's going to start a rumour saying that I'm writing a sequel called The Todgers.
Yes, please.
It's like digs as well, which is something with like these kind of like, yeah, these temporary kind of makeshift living conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.